Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl. And what's on tap tonight, Charlie?
Seven gunmen in the Old West come together to help a poor village against an army of brutal strongmen in the remake of The Magnificent Seven.
Ah, and we also have storks moving on from delivering babies to packages. But when an order for a baby appears, the best delivery stork must scramble to fix that error by delivering the baby.
Oh dear, I hope he does.
Yeah.
A girl from Uganda sees her world change after being introduced to the game of chess in Disney's Queen of Katwe.
And finally, a documentary that I just finished watching 10 minutes ago, Charlie, about a famous director and an actress who are allegedly kidnapped by a movie-obsessed dictator in North Korea. In the documentary, The Lovers and the Despot.
I didn't think you'd watch it. I'm surprised you did.
I watched it because I knew you'd be surprised if I did.
So last week's awful Zinfandel is actually still sitting here. The whole half bottle, I forgot it all week, and it's been just chilling here. That's where it's going to remain. But both of us, coincidentally, brought a bottle of wine tonight. We opened yours, but I left the bag on it because I don't want to know what it is, because we both bought wines that we thought matched this week's film. So what am I drinking right now?
So you are drinking a wine called True Grit, and it is a Cabernet Sauvignon. And True Grit is, of course, it's got some Western cowboy boots on the label.
Spurs and everything.
And so it is the king of red wines, pitiless and double tough, and rich, full-bodied with signature elements of earth and tobacco. It's a bit uncivilized, kind of like The Magnificent Seven.
Well, I chose the same movie to match.
I figured you would.
But I think I got closer.
Okay.
So here's the, I want to see if you can figure it out.
Oh, that was my second choice. I was actually looking at that one as well.
I picked a Malbec called Alamos because in the movie, one guy says, my grandfather died at the Alamo. And another one of the Magnificent Seven said, my grandfather probably killed your grandfather at the Alamo.
We were definitely on the same wavelength there because I did see that wine as well. And that was my second choice. So there you have it. We are.
That's awesome.
We've got plenty to drink.
The reason they're talking about that is because the remake of the remake, The Magnificent Seven, is the most socially diverse, progressive, leading forward cast, especially in 1879, you'll ever see. What did you think about that? Did it work?
It worked. I'm not a huge Western fan, like the traditional Westerns, and this is very much a traditional Western, a very high body count, but because of the ensemble cast, that's what made it work for me. I actually thought they were all very, very good, and that diversity really made for an interesting movie.
I loved how they brought it to bear. So up front, the bad guy does his bad guy thing. Peter Sarsgaard is this sociopath, and he murders a bunch of innocent people. He's trying to steal their land, and so he can mine for gold. Really bad dude, just an awful opening scene. But who's going to save them? You've seen this all before. In Long Shot, there's this hazy person on a horse, and you think it's going to be cigar-chomping, needs-a-shave Clint Eastwood. It's not. It's a black man wearing black clothing on a black horse. It's Denzel!
Gotta love Denzel Washington.
That man sticks out in the Old West.
He does, but he commands that screen from the moment he appears.
He's pulling a little Samuel L. Jackson from The Hateful Eight. They're both bounty hunters. He's got that going on. He's got a past. He's one of the few, one of the seven, that has a backstory. We kind of learn where he's coming from, why he chooses to help the helpless. And the other six, who he, for about an hour, gathers up, they just kind of, okay, I feel like fighting today. You know? That's kind of how that turns out. Chris Pratt as Josh Faraday. He's a gambler. He's a, pardon the stereotyping, but he's a drunk Irishman.
Mm-hmm. A good-looking drunk Irishman.
And the diversity falls from there. The Mexican, who he has no backstory. I have no idea what he's doing there. He gets in tight with Chris Pratt, right. And they're mortal enemies. The Confederate sharpshooter, played by Ethan Hawke, is best friends with what they call the Chinaman. Mm-hmm. He's actually played by a South Korean actor, and he's really good with knives, what do you know? And the Native American, the Comanche, becomes really good friends with the renowned Indian killer, right. Played by Vincent D'Onofrio. Vincent D'Onofrio, by the way, was he really good, or was he chewing the scene with that voice?
It was a little odd, but I think he needed something in order to compete and to stick out among that merry band of crazies. And so I think the voice was a bit of almost comic relief, I felt. And so it was bizarre, but it was okay.
The movie, at the end, I felt like three pieces of pie. Number one, okay, I'm going to get introduced to this pie. Number two, first battle, set up for the big battle. And number three, the long big battle. It reminded me of the Three Amigos, like Chevy Chase and Steve Martin go to Santapuco. What are you really good at? Okay, use that to fend off the bad guys. And that's kind of what they do here.
Yeah, but there are a lot more bad guys, and there are a lot more bodies that pile up.
PG-13 bodies.
Oh, my goodness. PG-13, I mean, granted,
there's no blood.
It's not graphic violence. Therefore, I think that's why it gets away with the PG-13 rating. But it is bodies falling left and right nonstop for about a half hour at the end there. And so it's kind of brutal. I mean, it is not for anyone who doesn't like watching or isn't okay watching a lot of violence on the screen. So this is not your like Big Valley and, you know, Heath and the rest of the Barclays are coming to protect some land. And this is a much more stick 'em up, shoot 'em out, shoot 'em up type of movie, and so you just have to be okay with that. You have to be prepared for it, and it is a traditional Western, even though it's an untraditional approach to telling this story. It is still very much like a conventional Western, and so if you like that genre, I think you're going to absolutely like The Magnificent Seven. If you don't already like that genre, then I liked Hell or High Water much better, which came out recently as well.
Hell or High Water blows this out of the water.
It does. Just,
they're not even close.
Yeah.
But this is a contemporary Western.
Mm-hmm.
The heroes are darker. And the dialogue is 2016 dialogue. They didn't go back to the 1800s. They're talking like we talk. And it's a bit more accessible now than the 1960 John Sturges version. By the way, the director, Antoine Fuqua, he's worked with Denzel a couple times before. He did Training Day. He did The Equalizer. Both far more violent films than this one.
Yeah.
And he kept a very famous line of dialogue. So in 1960, Denzel was actually Yul Brynner. And so another minority playing the lead role. And he has that line, I've been offered a lot from what I'm worth, but never everything. And they both said it, and Yul Brynner said it a lot better. Chris Pratt was Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Oh man, I think he did a little bit better too.
Well, I full disclosure, I don't think I ever saw the original from beginning to end, or the original. It was Seven Samurai.
Mm.
I never saw that one either. So 50s and 60s movies, I haven't necessarily gone back to catch. But this director also did Olympus Has Fallen.
Ech.
And I like that movie, but it also was extremely violent and had a very high body count. So once I realized that it was the same director, then I'm not as surprised at just how violent a movie it was. I mean, and again, not total graphic violence, but still a lot of people die in this movie.
Now, while he is being very diverse and progressive, there are no females in the Seven, but there is a very strong female. She's the lead townsperson, becomes their spokesman, really, and their fundraiser. And she's like, "Hey, we're gonna get her done." And unlike the first two iterations, there's a very strong female role here.
Yeah, she was. I won't give anything away, but she was married to the Matt Bomer character, and I
remember him from Magic Mike.
Yeah, well, he's from a lot of things, and he was in. He played a CIA guy in white collar on TV, but it's he's not in it long enough, but he's very
he provides her motivation.
He provides her motivation for going out and recruiting the guy who would then recruit the Magnificent Seven to help defend the town. And so she's a pretty badass herself, which was a nice touch.
By the way, what a silly title, the Magnificent Seven. What a stupid adjective. Remake it, fine. Everyone knows what you're remaking it from. But give it a new title. The Magnificent Seven does not translate to 2016. No one would name this posse, this haphazard ad hoc group, the Magnificent Seven.
But then what would you call it? And then everyone would go like, it's a remake of the Magnificent Seven.
And they're already saying it's a remake of the Magnificent Seven. Yeah. But give it a title that has some punch, one that's just not so second grade. It's magnificent. It's seven of them. They're magnificent.
And I didn't have a problem with that, except for the fact that I just sort of had to go back and figure out exactly what the first movie was about so that I knew how to compare the two. A perfectly enjoyable Western, but really for people who like a good Western.
Yeah. No, I take it or leave it. I gave it a positive review. I liked it. You'll have a good time, but you're gonna forget about it.
Yeah, you'll forget about it until the next Magnificent Seven comes out in another 30 years or so.
Another movie I think people are going to forget about is the animated feature for this week. It's not Pixar. It's not Disney. It's Warner Brothers. It's their second animated film ever, Storks.
I think they'll forget about it, but I think just like The Magnificent Seven, it's a decent movie. So I can recommend it for, you know, parents who have kids who just want to go see an animated movie. Storks, you know, everyone will say Storks delivers. It's the cliche. It's the pun you're never going to hear the end of, I can guarantee you, for the next several days. But it is fine for what it is. It's got very good voice talent.
It does.
Mm. I like them. I like these characters. It was a sweet story. Mm. I think a lot of parents are going to have a lot of splaining to do at the end of it, because I think a lot of kids are going to be ordering up brothers and sisters from the Stork Factory.
No, heads up. I mean, they're going to... It begs the question. You know, they say storks no longer deliver babies. There's other ways to do it now. And every kid in the audience is going to look at mom and dad and be like, oh, yeah? Well, how did I get here if it wasn't by a stork? What was it?
Yeah, so the premise is that storks no longer deliver babies. The baby-making part of their little plant has been shut down. And storks now deliver packages for a large...
Cornerstore.com.
Cornerstore.com, which is... Amazon.
It's Amazon.
It's Amazon.
They're like the drones that Amazon's trying to do.
Exactly. It's ripped from the headlines. But what happens, though, is this one human, the one and only human who lives on Stork Mountain, because she was not delivered as she was supposed to be many years before, is a real screw-up. She's supposed to get fired. The stork is supposed to fire her, but instead he exiles her to this long-dormant part of the plant. She hits a wrong button. A kid has asked for a baby brother, and next thing you know, there's this baby that they then have to try and deliver without the big boss finding out. And so there's a stork named Junior who ends up going on this adventure with the girl... the orphan tulip, as she is known, and they go and try and deliver this baby, and there's a whole big adventure and fun little side characters that are quirky and fun, and so I was absolutely fine with it. And I think who are your favorite characters?
Well, I'll get to them. my biggest and the reason why the film is so tedious is the main story, the central plot, is not good. It's an adventure story. It's a journey with an odd couple. Junior the Stork, Andy Samberg, does not get along with Orphan Tulip. Her name's Katie Crown. They fight because, you know, Junior is type A. He is the best delivery stork there is. He's going to become the boss on Monday, barring any screw-ups. Gee, I wonder what could happen. And Tulip is type B. She's like, hey, man, just go with it. And, you know, if things get a little messy, it's okay. So along the way, they have to learn lots of lessons about family, and family can be wherever you are and who you find, and maybe they'll become friends at the end. I don't know. I think I saw this in Toy Story.
Yes.
So I hated the story, it is packaged very well with some very memorable, funny, supporting characters, namely the Wolf Pack.
Yeah.
Key and Peele. Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele play Alpha and Beta Wolf. They are hysterical. They fall in love with the baby, and they call it the tiny thing, and we must raise this tiny thing, and oh, I love the tiny thing. And the wolf pack forms vehicles and
bridges
to take the baby away from Junior and Tulip, and it's hysterical. That works so well, Hannah.
It is. It's all very clever, and my favorite side character was this coworker of theirs named Pigeon Toady.
What's up, brah?
Voiced by Stephen Kramer Glickman, who I've never heard of. But, yeah, he has that
because everyone at the office has that guy.
Yeah.
What's up, brah?
Yeah,
what's see the up, game brah? Last night?
Like, what are you guys doing this weekend? Oh, okay. Great. Have fun. And so he's not a bad guy, but he kind of is like the snitch, you know? And he is quirky looking, and he's just a lot of comic relief, too. And so, you know, the whole package, I just thought it was a entertaining, very accessible movie for families to go and see. And not as good, doesn't reach the levels of a Zootopia for me, but is definitely better than so many of the others we've mentioned that were total misfires this year. You know, like Norm of the North, Ratchet and Clank. You know, this one and the one I saw last week, The Wildlife. This one is so much better than any of those that is why I'm willing to just tell people that if you've got kids, you want a family film to go see, you know, and you don't want to see a very high body count, this is probably the best movie for the younger kids. The next movie we're going to talk about is definitely, I think, one that could appeal to the slightly older kids. It's a good family movie.
You're right that this is better than the animated garbage we have seen to date. It's not as good as Finding Dory.
Right.
You know what it's right there with is The Secret Life of Pets.
See,
something you thought was going to be good.
And it's interesting you bring that up because I thought about it and I was like, I liked Storks better than Secret Life of Pets. I think a lot of people out there might disagree with me because those
I actually
who
agree
did,
with you. I think it's a little bit better.
And those who liked Secret Life of Pets might not agree, but I felt this one was the better package from beginning to end. It had the right pacing. It was a much more fun experience from beginning to end. And so, again, I think if you like Secret Life of Pets and if you like Zootopia and you've been waiting for some other animated movie to take the kids to, this is a fine choice.
Well, you mentioned the next movie for the older kids. That is Disney's Queen of Katwe, and they stuck to the Disney True Story formula. And you know what it is? It is, and I quote, "You are from blank, therefore you cannot play blank." You could be Jamaicans and bobsledding, yeah, you know, and
you can even be a horse.
You could be cross-country runners and fruit-picking Mexican-Americans, which was last year's McFarland USA.
Right.
This time is you are a slum-dwelling third-world girl from the slums of Uganda. You cannot play chess. And this 10-year-old girl who sells maize to drivers stuck in gridlock with her widowed mother, and they're just above the subsistence level, discovers she's really good at chess. She has a strategic thinking mind. She can see moves ahead. But you cannot play chess. Your family is starving. What is chess ever going to do for you? Turns out, oh my gosh, it does really good things.
Chess is a metaphor for life.
Never surrender your king.
Chess is definitely a metaphor for life in this movie. And I mean, it is based on a true story, but that's also what makes that formula for Disney work. And so you have, it's a feel-good movie. It's typical of all of those other Disney sports dramas based on a true story. But for me, the problem was that drama in chess is inherently limited. I mean, there's just only so much drama you can really put into a chess game when people are just kind of staring intently at a board. But it tries. And so it is. It's a true story of this girl. What's her name?
Fiona.
Fiona Mutesi?
Mutesi.
Yeah. Something like that. And she's got this mentor who is played by David Oyelowo.
Martin Luther King Jr. himself.
Yes, he was Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma. He was so good in that.
He was great.
And I think he's really one of the really great actors out there right now. And that he was so underappreciated, I think, in Selma. And he this is a good role for him. You know, he's very empathetic. He is one of these guys who basically puts his own personal ambitions aside in order to try and help these underprivileged kids learn chess and succeed and try and get them to think strategically and realize that they can do better, that they can better their circumstances. And that was one of the other like cheesy lines that I think was in there. It's like, it's not where you're at, it's where you're going, something like that.
The cheesiest one was a smaller girl was teaching
right.
Fiona the game, the moves, and she puts the pawn at the other end. This, the little one can become the big one.
The little one can become the big one. That's true. Although the kids were
They were great.
They were cute, and they were real characters.
Kampala, Ugandan kids from the slums. Like, yeah. They were really good.
Yeah. Oh, and the other sort of casting coup they have was Lupita Nyong'o as
Oscar winner, Lupita Nyong'o?
Oscar winner, and who everyone will likely remember from 12 Years a Slave. And so her role, you know, she's the typical... how is this going to help my kid? And I need my kids to help me support the
family. They need to get out there and earn.
Yeah. And so, of course, she's resistant at first, not understanding that this is really her kid's opportunity to get out. And so, of course, you know, gradually, because this is a Disney overcoming the odds movie, she warms to the idea and all's well that ends well. But... It's a good movie for, I would say, the older kids. It's a good family movie.
Oh, the youngsters will not have the patience for this.
Yeah.
It's 2 hours, like,
it's
to the
way
minute.
Way too long.
And it felt like three.
It felt way
this
too
thing
long.
Dragged.
Yeah. It was ironic that it lasted 2 hours and nothing happens in chess. And so if any movie should have been shorter, it's this one. But the end credits redeemed what was a very boring kind of, you know, when it felt so slow and you just wanted it to end, when they got to the credits, you actually were sort of re-engaged by what they do with bringing back, showing off the real people with the actors who portrayed them. And that was fun to see.
That worked. I liked that part. There was one, so it was so slow and I was just getting so bored. But there was one point where they latched on to what the story could have been. She goes to this huge tournament, and she's playing very well-pampered kids. Kids who have nannies, kids who get government stipends, and she beats them. She's better than they are. She comes back home to the slum, and she says, if I am better than them, why am I here? Why do I not get those things? And she cannot reconcile the two worlds, and she becomes kind of a snot to her mother. She's like, I don't want to clean anymore. I don't want to sell maize. And right there, that's the movie. And we got 4 minutes of that, and then they moved on to another montage.
The character, the turns in the character development were a little too contrived. Like, they were a little too sharp. Like, she went from, that was a very brief period of rebellion that she went through before she got herself back on track. And so that was glossed over quite a bit. And but again, God, I wouldn't have wanted them to make this movie any longer.
No, but they could have left out 3.5 montages.
That's
and maybe
true.
A tournament or two.
Yeah.
And another scene of her sweeping the floor or something. And,
that's
you
true.
Know,
there were ways to tighten it up.
There was a glimmer, a prism right there, and I think they missed it.
Well, but your glimmer might have caused some of the kids in the audience to tune out. So
trust me, all the kids were tuned. There was a lot of kids in our screening, and they lost it. They were bored.
The littlest ones were bored, but the older kids, I think, really appreciated this story about somebody who just kind of came from nothing and learned this game and just was good at it and managed to get this opportunity to really grow and to get better and to learn and all these factors that just came into play. So it's an inspiring movie. So you can't really fault it for, for not being as good as some of the... Well, actually, you can. It could have been better, but it was still good.
It's not as good as McFarland USA. Most recent one we have to compare it to is not as good as Cool Runnings.
Right.
It's just not as good as those.
It's not as good as those at all. I absolutely agree, but it's better than so much of what else is out there for that age group. And so I applaud the effort to actually create a movie that that shows a different part of the world that a lot of kids aren't really exposed to.
It's not as good as the other chess movie from this year from the other part of the world called The Dark Horse.
Absolutely.
About the teacher rather than the students, but, and they are not as bad off as these Ugandan kids, those New Zealand kids. That chess movie kills this one.
It's better. From a drama perspective, certainly The Dark Horse is a better movie. But what the difference is, that's a much darker R-rated movie that focuses on bipolar disorder and has much more adult themes. So the difference is, if you like chess, I suggest you see both of these movies. I suggest you actually, or if you like Katwe, Queen of Katwe, I would suggest looking for The Dark Horse.
Well, no one saw The Dark Horse, so I know, go find it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the lead actor in The Dark Horse was so good.
Still in my top three of the year for actors.
Yeah, and it reminded me just how good that was. So it made me want to actually give that movie another shout out.
Well, parallel worlds here. Queen of Katwe, second chess movie this year. The documentary we saw, The Lovers and the Despot, second North Korean documentary this year. The first one was Under the Sun, which was far better than The Lovers and the Despot.
See, I don't have that one to compare it to. I did watch The Lovers and the Despot, so I think I get bonus points, don't
I've heard this story before. I lived in South Korea for 365 days to the day, and I've heard this story. Very famous actress, South Korea's probably most famous actress from the 50s and 60s, and her director husband. They made a whole bunch of very famous movies in the 50s and 60s. They slowed down, they got divorced, and then she goes to Hong Kong, she gets kidnapped.
Allegedly.
But it's pretty convincing that I think she got kidnapped. He goes to Hong Kong, something happens, they both wind up in North Korea. Because Kim Jong-il, well-known movie cinephile, man loved his films, and he hated North Korean films. They're all propaganda pieces. They're all the same.
They're depressing.
Glory to country, I will die for my country, and they're just not good movies. Mm-hmm. And so he, allegedly, has South Korean actress and director kidnapped to come to North Korea to reinvigorate North Korean cinema and make North Korean good movies that can rival the movies from the South. And how much participation, willingness the two have, the lovers, I don't know. Yeah. It's nebulous.
It's very nebulous.
She's still alive. She's a talking head on screen telling her side of the story. He's dead. But they brought back tapes, recorded tapes. How they did that, I have no idea.
Yeah.
It was like the first time the world had heard the voice of Kim Jong-il from the Hermit Kingdom. He does not talk on film. And they heard him. And he's corroborating their story. Yes, I'm sorry I did that to you. I threw you in prison for 4 years. My bad. Make some good movies, man. But this documentary is not hard-hitting as it should be.
Well, I think that's just because of the fact that you are focusing on the voice of this woman and her perspective, and they have to be sympathetic, or they have to almost plant this benefit of the doubt throughout the film that their story, as they perceive it to be, is the true story. And it has holes. There are holes to this couple's story. And But it's fascinating nonetheless. It's sort of one of these very weird yet fascinating documentaries that if you are at all a student of like foreign film history and political science, you still might enjoy just this really weird story. Or some people might even remember when this couple actually defected to the U.S. I think it was like 1986.
86, yeah.
And so I think if you remember that story, or you know anything about this director who then they moved and ended up moving to Hollywood, and he directed like some ninja movies, but was not very successful.
He produced The Three Ninjas.
Yeah.
I remember that when I was a kid.
So
I didn't know it was him.
But their story is strange, and there are a lot of unanswered questions. And while it's really interesting to hear these microcassette recordings that they smuggled out that is them talking to Kim during the time that they were sort of supposedly pretending to support him, and that essentially they felt that they were going to just keep doing their movies and do good work, and they lived the high life in North Korea. Their scenario is that, well, we were doing it all with an eye toward eventually someday escaping, but we had to plan it carefully, and some of the stuff just didn't wash, and that they would leave their kids behind. That just was always very strange to me. And then there's no mention of this guy's second wife and kids. Like, that just completely is hinted at early in the movie and then disappears from the radar.
He got divorced because he founded a second family. And there is no second family in this movie.
Yeah.
The filmmakers noticeably did not have a lot to work with. They had a couple pictures, which they beat to death. And when they play the tapes, they did what you hated in the J.T. Leroy story. They show like a tape recorder. And I know you don't like that. And it actually, after a while, it got on my nerves too.
I was okay with it in this case because it's having to be translated. And so there really is no other way to you get away with it a little easier because you're actually having to translate what they're saying. So you can kind of put that onto the screen and be typing out the English part of their discussions. And so I was more forgiving of that device in this particular movie. There's a lot of stuff where you're like, was that the real stuff or is that recreated? And there's a lot of stuff that
I think a lot of it is recreated.
A lot of it's recreated, and then a lot is like movie footage from their movies. But it was very hard to sympathize with them. I don't know if we were supposed to, but I couldn't in the end because they really were living such a better life than anyone else in the North. And they turned their backs on their family in the South. And for years, they lived a very good life. And the photos of them traveling the world and with Kim Jong-il standing there, they look pretty darn happy. They're not the kind of photos where they look like captives who are trying to send a signal with their eyes.
Well, you don't do that in front of Kim Jong-il. He will kill you.
And I think it would have been even more interesting. You know, it puts a lot into better perspective, though, for the brouhaha that happened over the interview when that movie came out a couple years ago, and how that started such a firestorm with North Korea. It's because it really insulted Kim Jong-il. And so Kim Jong-un. I'm sorry, getting my Kims mixed up. But I think having been aware of the craziness of the backlash over the interview and all the stuff that triggered, then watching a movie like this, you kind of understand that a little more, just how obsessed this family was with movies in Korea and wanting to make better movies and treating filmmakers and this star like national treasures after kidnapping them and putting them through the ringer for a few years. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that went on like in these early years when they were first brought to North Korea that don't quite wash. Like, it was just, the whole story was just very, very strange.
Well, thank you for reminding me of the interview. That movie wasn't very good. So if there's a movie to pick a fight over, yeah, it probably wasn't the interview. It was a stupid movie.
But it had nothing to do with the movie,
so,
the fight.
Like the Queen of Katwe had that 4 minutes where they had the movie. Mm-hmm. There was 4 minutes where Lovers and the Despot had it. Shin, the director, the older man in the relationship, goes up there, and his career was kind of stale. It was dead in South Korea. Now he goes to North Korea, and he has an unlimited budget. Yeah. He can write his own movies. He can direct his own movies. He can cast his own movies. It's free reign, and it shows that, and he made 17 movies in 3 years. Yeah. I think this guy, right there, where it shows he was having, he could do what he wanted to do finally cinematically, mm-hmm. That was it. If they had picked that point and dove way down to the bottom, they would have had it. And they moved on to something else after that.
Well, and I wonder if they moved on because the jig would have been up. I think they already had enough seeds of doubt planted about his story because they mentioned very early on that he had like creditors after him and stuff in South Korea and that he was having business problems and he was not able to make the movies anymore that he really wanted to make. And so suddenly he's kidnapped. He's a political prisoner for a while in North Korea. And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, he's like head of the film industry in the North and is treated like royalty. And it's just, it's hard not to really wonder. And then suddenly they're able to come to the U.S. and get asylum and pick their lives back up without all the baggage that they had in South Korea.
Well, they still had baggage. To this day, South Koreans think she was kidnapped.
Yeah.
He went.
Yeah. My gut would kind of move in that direction, or that she was kidnapped. He maybe was not aware that she was going to be kidnapped, or maybe wanted, you know, who knows? Well,
it sounds like he went to Hong Kong and just kind of hung out at the bar and be like, yeah. Hey, you know who I am?
Yeah.
Someone come and find me.
Yeah, and take me to whoever. But the fact that it took them like 4 years to be reunited once they were both in North Korea, the whole thing was just, it's a very strange story. And you don't, in the end, it's really hard to know what to believe.
And it pales in comparison to Under the Sun, which was a propaganda film. North Korea let this Eastern European film crew in to, they thought they were going to stage stuff. But they forgot, there's editing later. And it shows how corrupt and inept and just what a facade the entire regime is and how silly it was. That one is one of the top 10 documentaries of the year. And it knocks this one off just any documentary list.
Huh. And I missed that one. That was at the AFI Documentary Festival, and I remember
it had a very limited release after that, but I think it's going to come around Screen Your Time.
Do you?
I have a hunch.
Well, if it does, then maybe I'll give it a go, since I did successfully manage to get all the way through this documentary.
Look at you, dude. All right, to recap, what I think is weirdly, unexpectedly, the best film of the week, the remake of the remake, Magnificent Seven, Diversity Rules. I dug it.
Yeah, it's not typically a type of movie that I would care for, but I think the ensemble cast makes it much more accessible to everybody, and I enjoyed it.
Storks, middle of the road, plot stinks, supporting characters are awesome.
I thought the plot was just fine, and the supporting characters were great, and I think it's a fine choice for the younger kids.
Disney's Queen of Katwe, your child will probably fall asleep.
And you may too, but at its core, it's an inspiring tale in that whole genre of, you know, rags to riches kind of stories. And if you like that sort of thing and you're looking for a good family drama, then it might be worth checking out.
The documentary, The Lovers and the Despot, go see Under the Sun.
I don't think anybody's going to see The Lovers and the Despot, although I found it rather intriguing.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll see what we get on about concerning wine the next time. That's all. I'm really excited about that now that we have this thing about wine. So thank you for listening. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.